And we're back. Welcome to Speak Up Las Cruces. For the next half hour, we're going to be talking with Joe Roach, mostly about Ukraine, but you are a former Marine, and so the Uniform Code of Military Justice means something to you as well.
Oh, it sure did. They drummed it into us. It's, otherwise, you have a bunch of people wandering around with no, what are the appropriate things that one should be allowed or not allowed to do. And it was a guidebook. We saw it as a guidebook.
Yeah.
I don't believe any of us ever read it all the way through. I mean, it's terribly, terribly legalistic in that sense. So, yeah.
But you knew what...
That's right. Yeah. And it applied to me. The other thing you knew, if it applied to me and I had to do it, then Pete Hogsworth has to do it.
That's right.
It goes all the way up to
the top.
And
yeah.
That admiral he's fingering is a Navy SEAL who's well decorated. So,
and he'll be testifying before Congress today. So,
yeah. I'd hate to see a guy's career end like that.
I would too.
Pete won't leave him.
He won't leave on his own.
No, Donald doesn't care what he does. I don't think.
No, I agree with you, but the pressure, we'll see.
Yeah.
I mean, he's been impervious to pressure thus far.
Yeah, we'll see.
We'll see.
Yeah.
So, speaking of our commander-in-chief, he has put together his 28-point plan, I believe it was, after consulting carefully with the Russians, and he was asked by a reporter, what concessions are the Russians making in your 28-point plan? And his answer was, well, they're going to stop fighting. That's their concession for the time being. Where do you see things? Where are we at right now?
It's a very good place to start because there's been so much bloodshed. It's been such a major war.
Yeah.
I mean, the Russians have lost over 1 million troops. And the casualty rate, we get these numbers, they're really quite good. I mean, valid by good. It's a 5-to-1 ratio, which means for every single Ukrainian, there's 5 casualties for Russians. Anybody who's ever attended any infantry training program or whatever will tell you the ideal number for casualties is somewhere between 3 to 5. In other words, you want to get in that 3-to-1, 5-to-1.
Mm-hmm.
And that means no matter what the other side's doing and no matter how many inches they're accumulating,
right, which is what's
they're losing.
Happening. Well, are they, though? I mean, that's the question because it seems like they're just throwing people into the meat grinder, and it's, I know they don't have an endless amount, but it seems like they're not running short yet.
They're on the precipice. There are two things, too. It's one thing to draft soldiers. It's another thing to draft soldiers who know how to tie their shoes.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And how to brush their teeth. And the picking is mighty slim. Among the Russian age group, that they're first of all, they're not Russians. They're out in Central Asia.
Yeah.
They're Muslims. They are Azerbaijanis or whatever.
Right.
The bright, their peers in St. Petersburg and Moscow.
They're not going.
Going to the cocktail parties.
Yeah,
they're
right.
Not. Their daddies have got the influence to keep them out of it. So it is a colonialism that's left over. That they just you're right. They just use this endless stream, but the stream is now coming back. You can't hide 1 million casualties.
No, of course.
He could get away with something in the first year, but not anymore. So there's great restlessness. I'd like to talk to you at the end about what I foresee for Putin.
Okay.
And there are some straws in the wind now. But as far as these numbers are concerned, it's to acquire a precious little territory. Do you know, Walt, and I could be corrected on this, but they have gained something like 12% of Ukrainian territory
right.
in this offensive, okay? And they have spent 1 million men to do it.
Right.
And in the meantime, people never hear this one. The Ukrainians have captured 4% of Russian territory around the city of Kursk. The most famous tank battle in history was fought around the city of Kursk. And it just drove Putin crazy. But they are still there.
Okay.
So a year later, the net gain of 1 million men, net gain 8% of the Ukrainian territory.
I guess there's been a big battle or a long battle in the city of Pokrovsk.
Yes.
And that's apparently an important can you talk about that? Has Russian taken that city? And if so, what does that mean?
Yes. Good. You guys are keeping up on this stuff. Pokrovsk is a rail and small industry center in the south. There are two provinces that Putin is trying to capture complete control of. Donetsk and so it's in Donetsk, and it's an important transportation link. The thing to remember about it, though, is that it will give the Russians access to nothing more than what they had before, and what they are conquering is about as level as Hiroshima was or Berlin at the end of World War II. It is just complete and total rubble.
Yeah.
So what's the prize there? The prize is he can beat his chest in negotiations and say, I've got you on the run.
Yeah. Which he's doing.
He's doing. Now, we'll get around here to talking about how effective it is, because times are changing. See, there's not going to be more change of I'm a strange guy when I look at this stuff. The Ukrainians and Russians are in the midst of something called the Rasputitsa. It means mud bath. In the fall month of November, it stopped the Germans in World War II. And literally, the puddles of mud, thick mud, it's about as high as this room we're in. And so a tank a truck or in anything. So it makes life quite miserable for anybody who's in the middle of it. And everyone knows you don't plan to make any advances once the Rasputitsa hits. And then after the Rasputitsa comes the dead cold of winter. Mm-hmm. And then it's merely a matter of trying to survive. By the way, I haven't tossed in the number of Ukrainian civilians who've died. We don't know about Russians because they don't tell us, but there aren't that many.
No.
Ukrainians are firing on oil refineries and so on.
That's right.
But it's something like 42,000 Ukrainian civilians of all ages. So, it's pure carnage. The question then, there's always a cost a cost-benefit analysis going on for each one of us. You know, am I going to buy those shoes? I don't know. Is it really worth it to me? I got to have them there. So, you know, or do I have to have them? And this is an optional war for the Russians. They could do this war or not do this war. They were actually in better they were much better condition economically, militarily, geopolitically.
Yep, no doubt.
Much better. They were one of the super guys you had to check with. Now they're, you know, you can't even beat a little runt like, Ukraine's not a runt.
No, that's not.
Yeah. So that's the way I look at it. It's cost benefit. I don't care. They don't have an endless supply of troops.
Right.
Much less Russians. It aren't Russians anymore.
I guess that's my question. Well, yeah, I understand that. But I guess my question is, can Ukraine survive 3 more years of Donald Trump? I know Europe is doing the best it can to backfill and to, you know, make up for what we have stopped sending. But
yes. When you cover something like this carefully, you analysts tend to say, how did this happen? Why did this happen? And do we see anything coming out of the fog later? Mm-hmm. Seen anything starting to emerge out of it? You're not going to see that in week one or year one or battle season one. What I'm seeing is what a lot of European and a lot of Asians are seeing, this steady decline of American influence. Mm-hmm. We could go over that in some detail. But the reason why is that the Europeans don't trust Trump. Mm. He has, okay, I'm going to give you another chance, Jimmy. All right, Jimmy takes another chance.
Right.
I'm going to give you another chance, Jimmy. Sooner or later, that was your last one, Jimmy.
Right.
And the Europeans are well beyond that. And the proof of my point is that the Europeans are beginning to, in the early stages of developing tactical nuclear weapons,
right,
so they won't have to rely on the U.S. The French have them, the British have them, and now everybody, there's a consortium. And the same thing is happening in the East, in the Pacific, where I served. Japan, Korea, and Taiwan are all what the atomic scientists call nuclear latency nations. In other words, what does that expression mean? I kept looking for that, and one of the guys in the conference said it means they're a couple of screwdriver twists away from
having nukes.
And able to go ahead because they've got the know-how and they've got the materials. So the same thing then is happening in among our Pacific allies. They don't trust Trump. How could anybody in a right mind, would you trust your life and your whole existence to, because there might be, and it is true, he has some good days and some good ideas, but there are many, many fewer as time is passing by. And consequently, the world outside of Las Cruces is beginning to see that the loser in this war is going to be Putin for sure, but also the U.S. Mm-hmm. Even in your personal relationships, trust is something you have to work on, and once you lose it, it's even more difficult to get it back.
Yeah.
So the cost of this to the U.S. Is not in dollars and cents. It's who's blowing up fishing boats?
Yeah, exactly. We're the bad guys now. Yeah.
But it's worse than being the bad guys. I mean, it isn't like, I mean, at least when we went to war, Spanish war with Cuba, there was a battleship that was blown up in the harbor in Havana. I mean, a speedboat. Now, mind you, I think they probably could have a program of interdicting drug dealers, but it isn't just it's aircraft also. So the long and the short of it is, we have done terrible destruction to ourselves, and also the Russians. So the two losers are Russia.
Yeah, the two great powers
that emerge out of this smoke, you guys. And the two winners that are emerging out of smoke, sitting there with a bowl of soy in hand, is China,
yeah,
and Europe. Mm-hmm. This is a resurgence of Europe. I won't be here to see it, but school children will be seeing the resurgence of Europe, and a lot of it has to do with our inconsistent, irrational, just any number of things you can say about. We don't have a policy. I defy any Republican in this audience,
right,
to tell me what American foreign policy is under Donald Trump.
America first.
Right. That's what I was going to say. That well, America first has always, right, what he's been touting, you know, from the podium since before he became president was America first. So that's the...
But what does that mean?
Right. Anything that's supposed to serve America. But even then, what you're saying, right, is that even with that policy or that mindset, we're stand to lose in this America first mindset with this war between Ukraine and Russia.
Okay. Beyond that, Republicans, tell me where we've mounted a great success anywhere in geopolitics in this man's second term.
Oh, yeah, right.
No, anywhere. No, anything.
We have.
Did we win a Cupid doll at the festival? I mean, we haven't won.
We have managed to anger the Canadians. You got to go a spell. Right, I mean, they're the slowest to anger people in the world.
Yeah, yeah. I wish I could be around to write this history.
Yes.
Great Donald Trump. He angered and broke relations with the Canadians and invaded Venezuela.
Yeah.
Yay. Big America, yeah. But Venezuela does make sense, guys. It has the oil. That's what Trump and his pals. They're going to have that oil.
Yeah, yeah. Their production is way down, but their resources, they have the largest resources in the world, I think. Larger than Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, close to it.
So let's talk about Putin. He is in his 70s now. Is that right?
Right. Yeah.
Obviously, to him, he doesn't care about anything. He said that the breakup of the Soviet Union was the greatest catastrophe of mankind or whatever.
Yes.
And he sees it as his mission to reverse that wrong. How much buy-in does he have on that in the Russian among the public? And how does he die? Does he die the leader of Russia, or does he die in exile somewhere?
Mm.
Good question, Walt. About 2 years ago, you and I kicked this around a little, and I told you the way to understand the way things are run in Moscow is to go back and watch the movie The Godfather. This is a mafia clan here. It's not... It defies normal political analysis, okay. But there are a bunch of people with a whole lot of power and willing to kill to get it if they need it. Putin came out of the ranks of the KGB. As you know, he was an assassin. You can see it in Dresden, Germany, East Germany. The East German archives, they revealed his ID card. You can see it if you go to Dresden. So he's a killer, and the friends around him are killers. They don't care about niceties. His goal is to accumulate maximum wealth and to be regarded as the man who rebuilt the fallen Soviet Empire. And so he's out to do that. And everything else, it doesn't matter to him. Now, a few moments ago I said, they were in great position a few years ago. I mean, they were rolling in money, oil money, and the big shots were squirreling it away in the bank in Panama and Malta, and jobs were fine. Prices were okay. I was going to tell you today the price of beets and potatoes. That's the top of the Russian health chain. They have doubled in price this year. So while I joke around a little here, those ordinary folks, and I've been in plenty of ordinary homes or apartments and so on, they're hurting. Okay, so they're not going to go out marching in the streets. The message they get is this guy is Stalin 2.0. And you go out in the streets, you become a part of something like that. And while it's bad here, it's even worse out in Siberia, because that's where you're headed.
Yeah.
Okay, so there's no street revolution I see coming. He's killed off most of the resistance
opposition.
Movement.
Yeah, right.
they either fall through windows or die in prison or what have you. So now we're sitting with all these guys with all, and there are some women as figureheads, but not many. So there he sits, and perfect position, raking the money in, thumbing his nose at the West, and he decides to invade in Ukraine. Just that is the nuttiest thing. It'll rank real high in history. You go to war to do some to accomplish something. What, you know, when you know you're throwing away one to get the other. So the way I see it, we're at the stage of the blame game.
In Russia, yeah.
Doesn't have anything to do with those poor people.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, they ration the heat and you can't get gasoline for your motor scooter. Okay, that's all horrible. But for the big shots, wait a minute. Who said we should do this?
Mm-hmm.
Did you, General, wasn't that your recommendation? Did you, KGB, FSB, Secret Security? He has removed 13 high-ranking commanding generals in the last 6 months and about a dozen high-ranking civilian officers in the government. So should I take a cough drop?
Yeah, go ahead.
So the point is, they're all starting to line up and point fingers
right
at the other guy, and the other guy is pointing back, and both of you are trying to figure out how are we going to slip out of this knot, because we can't blame the boss. Well, eventually. You know, whether you want it or not, the buck stops at the top.
Hmm.
And so, that's Putin.
Right. So then what is there anybody like on the horizon that you see potentially coming up and bubbling in terms of their leadership?
There are names, but it's a names game.
Yeah.
And every time that there was a power change in Soviet history, the one everybody thought that was going to get it never got it. So I personally refrain from.
I wait
for the learning commentators right. and the New York Times guys to give us the name, and then I say, "Well, now I'm sure it's not him."
Right.
What do you see as the future for Ukraine? Because they're going through a period where Zelensky's top guy just had to step down in a apparent corruption scandal. Obviously, this has been a devastating period for them, regardless of how, you know, it's devastating for both sides. But what's the future like for Ukraine, do you think?
Ukraine has shown it has a toughness.
No doubt about that.
And if you're going to invest in somebody, you don't want to invest in a weak person, right, or a weak company.
But what about the corruption? I mean, that has
Yes. It has been a corrupt government ever since the fall of the Soviet Union. But it is getting better.
Okay.
It is, and it lapses back and forth. I mean, the guy was as high-ranking as you want to be.
Right.
And he's raking in money. The way I see it, in history, Ukraine is about like East Germany before the wall fell.
Hmm.
What's going to happen?
Right.
What's going to happen after the wall falls? The investors poured in like crazy. They made a fortune, the investors. The economy of East Germany picked up. It never quite matched their West. Same thing's going to happen in Ukraine. They're having seminars now about foreign investment, how much foreign investment. Because the Ukrainians have shown, they'll make do with the littlest, silliest gadgets to get by.
Right.
And they're willing to be patient enough to do it. So I see people like the Germans and the Belgians and the Dutch and so on hopping into that market. There's always money looking for a place to invest. Maybe even those guys in that speedboat will be heading over to Rotterdam to invest in. Now, I'm laughing and joking, but it is pretty much a truism. Since World War II, money goes where it's a good investment. And if indeed this comes to what I think it's going to be, a Korean armistice, then the West and the people with the money, they're not going to go in unless Ukraine has a guarantee of security.
Right.
I mean, I used to work as a consultant for Caterpillar Incorporated. I remember the day that we were sitting in the meeting, and when Putin took over, not from vice president, he moved up to president, they all said, okay, that's it. Those KGB guys, we see the wind blowing.
Yeah.
We're going to this other place called China. And look what they've done with China, what they've done to participate in that revival. So I see that coming for Ukraine. That's my most positive look at it. As far as the end of the war,
right,
and these negotiations today, I try to refrain from reading too much because in 24 hours, the so-called conditions change.
Right.
And I think what we're going to discover, both those stubborn guys, Zelensky, for good reason sometimes, Zelensky and Putin, It's going to be a continuing standoff, and Trump gets his Nobel Prize because there's an armistice called, you know, it's Korea. You know enough about Korea that we never did sign a treaty to end that war.
We just kind of walked away.
In 1953, and it took 7 years of 7 years of negotiations. So the people asking, what do you think they're going to be doing over there tomorrow in Geneva or whatever? I think they'll be talking a lot. But the reality is I see a demilitarized zone,
right,
which happened in Korea, is happening. I see it happening with Ukraine, and there'll be some marginal exchange of territories, but not a lot. And after all that death and destruction and waste of resources, for what?
Yeah.
Colossal mistake. And it'll be regarded that way in history.
I think. We are down to our last minute. I know. I guess for the United States, certainly this isolationist period that we're going through, this can't be good for us either.
No, that's why I say, who are the winners? Who are the losers?
Yeah, that's right.
But I don't think it's going to last forever. It never has.
I think that's absolutely right. Well, Joe, it's always educational and informative whenever you come on, and like I said, you're our go-to guy on this subject, so we always appreciate you sharing your knowledge with us.
And also, you're a standing comedian, so hey, guys, thanks a lot.
Yeah.
You know, you really got me off and running with good questions.
Oh, well, thank you.